Measuring the costs of the uninsured, the FDA takes another look at acetaminophen, Con Ed for a steamy romance novel, and we're going to take a look at fish poisoning. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Welcome, Dan. Welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's episode, especially all you brand new listeners and probably a lot of recently graduated nursing students, which means you're graduate nurses, and maybe some of you have even moved on and passed your national exams, your NCLEX exams, in which case you are new RNs, and I want to congratulate you. And if you're new to the nursing show here, welcome to the show. And for you long-term listeners that have passed, hey, it's great to hear from you. You can look on our site this coming week. I'll have some information there if you haven't taken your test yet, some test-taking tips that I've been able to put together, and hopefully it'll help you better prepare for taking the exam. And I hope that that provides you another resource in case you're looking for some additional details and resources that can help you kind of be better in a frame of mind to be prepared to take the NCLEX exam. I think you've already passed through nursing school. You're probably as prepared as far as the knowledge you hold. It's more about taking the test itself at this point. So let's prepare you for that. So we'll have some things coming up this coming week that will give you some insights into some things you can do to get ready. For all of the long-term listeners, I also want to thank you for your continued support, emails, and contact here. It is always great to hear from the Nursing Show listeners, and I would urge you to get in touch with me if you have a news item you found, perhaps a link to another blog that you'd like me to take a look at, or an article. Send those links into me here so that I can take a look at them, and maybe we can get them featured here on The Nursing Show in a future episode. It's always great to hear in from you, and of course, any comments are appreciated, both good and bad. We want to improve things here, so if you've got something you'd like me to improve upon, or perhaps there's a correction that needs to be made, make sure you get in touch with me so that we can provide the rest of the Nursing Show community the best information possible and get the correct info out to them. If you need to contact me, that email address is comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also always leave comments directly on the Nursing Show site. There's a link at the bottom of every article on the Nursing Show site. And at the bottom of each article, you'll see a link that says leave a response or comments. Click that link and you can go ahead and leave your comment. And it's there for the rest of the community to look at and respond to, as well as for me to take a look at and respond to as well. And I try to get back to everybody, whether it's by email or if you leave a comment directly on the site. So please do so, and please continue to contribute your efforts to the community here at The Nursing Show. And of course, you can find all of that over at nursingshow.com. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'll start off with a story I picked up off of Reuters, and this is a report that is coming out of Washington from a group called Families USA. It's a healthcare reform advocacy group, and this group puts together an annual report examining the effect on a family's health insurance premiums when the additional costs that are caused to the system by uninsured persons are included or factored in. And what they believe and what they propose in this particular study and resource that they provide is they say that the cost of the uninsured individuals in our economy, as they seek health care and their costs are not able to be recovered by the physicians, the hospitals, and the other members of the healthcare system, those costs are passed on to the insurers. And the insurers pass that on to their premium policy holders. And of course, That means the rest of us, if we're insured, we have to pay the cost of that additional uninsured person because of the costs that are passed on by the healthcare system as a whole. And what they've estimated is that a family that is holding health insurance pays an estimated $1,017 more annually to assist in the pay for healthcare for uninsured individuals. And that is a shocking number, of course. You know, I think everybody would love to have an extra $1,000 in their pocket. They further break it down for family policies, individual policies. An individual policy holder pays close to $400 extra a year to cover the costs of the uninsured. And what this organization is saying, as we continue to look at healthcare reform in this country, is that people are paying for the uninsured healthcare, and that we're paying a hidden tax for this already. Why don't we bring these people into some kind of insurance program, some kind of managed care system, where we can actually provide them care at a much more cost-effective rate? And so that seems to be something that makes a lot of sense to me, and to a lot of other people. But I wanted to bring this up, depending on where you fall on this particular issue, it's still an important issue overall, and that is healthcare reform. So again, I always say, get involved, let your voice be heard. We are really the people that see, as nurses, we see so many different aspects of people's lives and their costs for healthcare, the way that they make decisions about their healthcare because of the economic factors involved. We talked last week in the news about the costs the recession is having on people making healthcare decisions because they've lost their job or they've lost part of their benefits or they're getting less money for whatever reason, and they have to make decisions about medications, decisions about getting treatment, and all of these things have a huge impact on the overall health of our communities. So it's something that we need to keep following up on, and I'll be bringing these types of stories to the front because I think it's important that we keep focusing on the different aspects of this. And if you have a different opinion, you know, please share it with us. It's just because I find this particular story interesting doesn't mean that there aren't other viewpoints. And I try to lay things out as evenly as I can. You probably understand which side I lean towards, but it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily right or wrong, but that I'm trying to present a viewpoint here. And I think that most of us can agree there needs to be some sort of change to the system in the way it's laid out now. And we may only differ on the types of changes that might be proposed. Moving right along, the FDA is looking at some changes in the way they look at acetaminophen. They're trying to cut the amount of liver injuries that are reported in the United States from over-the-counter acetaminophen overdoses. These are prescription products, over-the-counter products. This is acetaminophen or Tylenol is present in many medications, and yet people may not know that it is the pain reliever that's present in their particular allergy relief or cold medicine that they're taking. And they may not realize that they take the cold medicine and then they turn around and take Tylenol, that they are increasing their risk for having an overdose. And we've talked about acetaminophen overdoses before. We've had Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center on in past episodes talking about acetaminophen overdoses. And these are things that we can all review. And I'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes for that so that you can go back and listen to her take from the Maryland Poison Center. She talks a little bit about acetaminophen overdoses and some of the common medications that people mistakenly overdose on, and how we can look for that, educate our patients, and continue to provide good resources for our patients to have safe medication usage in the home. So this is something that the FDA is going to be looking at. This is a product that is widely used, as I said, and it's something that the FDA advisory committees that are taking a look at this are going to get together and consider if there's a way to keep the recommended dose down, to better label some of these combination products so that people understand it contains acetaminophen as one of the active ingredients, and that it's important that you don't take other medications that contain acetaminophen at the same time because you could risk overdosing. And they're saying that taking more than the recommended dose of 4 grams per day can cause liver damage, and it can cause abnormalities in blood tests. It can also move forward and cause acute liver failure or even death. And this is something that we can easily avoid by having better educational resources and better product labeling in some cases. So this is something that I think that they are looking at. I think something that needs to be at least considered and see if there's a way that we can approach this so that people are taking these medications safely and effectively. Finally, in the news, I'm going to wrap up with a very interesting story that I picked up over at medicalnewstoday.com. And it's a story of a nurse who is taking a, well, according to the article link, a novel approach to nursing education. You know, I think a lot of us will agree that there's nothing more boring than a dry, humongous nursing textbook. We all remember them. And if we are involved in education at all for new nursing students, we see the monstrous books that are lugged around and need to be, you know, you have to actually have a book holder sometimes for these things. They're so enormous. But I think we all can agree that these textbooks are not really known for their light reading material. So how can you do that? How can you make that a better experience? Anybody who knows me knows I'm a big proponent of having something that approaches something like edutainment. That's something that I learned about a long time ago from a couple of really great EMS educators when I was in my paramedic training. And I've brought that forward in my own training efforts to make sure that people are entertained and getting the information in a way that makes it easier to comprehend, easier to internalize, and move forward. Well, Amy Vega is a nurse. She's a healthcare educator at Southern Regional Area Health Education Center in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And she's put a lot of things together in one resource. And what she's done is, well, the article calls these stories steamy page turners. Nurses can read while cozying up next to the fireplace in their favorite comfy chairs. So that's what Amy Vega has done here. She has written two novellas. The first one is called Lions and Tigers and Nurses, and dealing with violence in the workplace, an issue that we're seeing more and more of. And so she puts it in the terms of a novel so that you can understand what's going on in the context of a great fiction story. There's a second novella called Broken Heart, which is about coping with change and loss, and that'll be available in June. And this is pretty amazing resource, and I'm looking forward to, I'm going to try to see if I can get Amy here on the show and maybe participate here in an interview where we can hear her talk a little bit more about this in person. But I just think this is a great idea, and I'm curious what the rest of you might think about a resource like this where you can learn and, you know, enjoy a hot romance novel at the same time. Maybe not my cup of tea, but I know it might be something my wife would appreciate if she were a nurse. She reads a lot of novels like that, and it might be something that would appeal to her. So I would be curious to see if it would be something that, you know, would be a guilty pleasure, maybe something you don't tell everybody you're reading, but you can go ahead and read it anyway. And heck, what if you got to take a little test at the end and have a little bit of continuing education credit along the way just for sitting and reading a good book? Time to jump into our tip and trick of the week this week. And this week's tip and trick of the week is another visit from our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. You can find additional resources, including signing up for Lisa's Tox Tidbits email newsletter over at mdpoison.com. Maryland Poison Center is a great resource, and you don't have to be from Maryland to sign up for that newsletter. It's a great way for you to find out more information about updates in toxicology, poison control information, and additional resources for people in all areas of healthcare and for consumer resources about poison control. You'll find all of that at the Maryland Poison Center in their website and links to other poison centers around the country. So without further ado, let's jump on in and see what Lisa has for us this week. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time again for another visit with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center and her tox tidbit for us. Lisa, how you doing?
Fine, thanks, Jamie.
So I heard you say you're going to be talking about fish poisonings this month. I really am interested to hear what that's all about.
Right, fish poisoning. And I think when you hear the term fish poisoning, you might think of fish that isn't prepared properly or old fish or something that causes food poisoning. But that's not really the case here. These are two different types of poisonings that occur with fish under different circumstances. So I'd just like to talk about those for a few minutes. So imagine you're evaluating a young woman or a young man, doesn't matter, who's complaining of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and weakness, but is also complaining of some very unusual symptoms. He or she is complaining of some sudden tooth pain, feels like their teeth are falling out, has numbness of the mouth, and a very strange burning feeling in the hands and feet, especially when he or she touches something cold. Very kind of odd signs and symptoms here. There's no past medical history that would help to diagnose her problem. So upon further questioning, you find out that she ate grouper at a seafood restaurant a few hours ago. So could this be the cause of her symptoms? Well, the answer is yes. This patient's suffering from something called Ciguatera fish poisoning. Ciguatera fish poisoning occurs when fish is eaten that contains toxins produced by an organism that grows on algae in tropical waters. This toxin accumulates in small fish that feed on the algae. Then in turn, these small fish are the major food source for larger fish. So the large fish eat the small fish, and the toxin becomes more concentrated in the larger fish, mainly in pretty much everywhere in the fish, but mainly in the fatty tissue of the fish, the flesh of the fish, and the viscera of the larger fish. So the fish most commonly involved in these poisonings include barracuda, red snapper, amberjack, grouper, surgeon fish, sea bass, parrotfish, sturgeon, and dolphin, and there are many other fish that can be involved as well. In the United States, poisonings occur most frequently in warm water areas, so around Hawaii, Florida, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and other tropical territories. However, fish do migrate sometimes, and they have migrated as far as South Carolina and Texas, where cases have been reported. Scientists theorize that with increasing water temperatures and changes in the fish migration patterns, the presence of this organism will maybe increase in the Gulf of Mexico and southern Atlantic coastline and work its way up the coast. Now, the cases that we hear about in Maryland and that we hear about in other more northern states usually involve people that have just returned from visits to areas where poisonings are more common, so the more tropical or warm areas. But also fish that have been shipped from southern waters to other areas have also resulted in poisonings. It's nearly impossible to detect the presence of the toxin. The appearance, the taste, and the smell of the contaminated fish are not altered, and the toxin is not destroyed by cooking or freezing. And it has nothing to do, really, with how the fish is prepared or how it's been stored or refrigerated prior to being prepared in the restaurant. The onset of clinical effects is usually within 2 to 6 hours, but it can be delayed for as long as about 30 hours after eating the contaminated fish. Numbness and pain of the mouth, the tongue, and the extremities, as well as some GI symptoms like abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and very profuse watery diarrhea are characteristic of the Ciguatera fish poisoning. Now, these GI symptoms might lead you to believe that there's a food poisoning going on here, but patients also exhibit these other more unusual symptoms that might clue you into the fact that it's due to the fish. Other effects that they might complain about are muscle weakness, sweating, itching, headache, watery eyes, blurred vision, a metallic taste, and chills. Now, the sensation of burning when hands and feet are in contact with cold objects has been described, and it's actually been described as a cold-hot temperature reversal. It's not really what happens, but that's how it's often described. Bradycardia, hypotension, hypothermia, and respiratory depression can also develop in severe cases. It's rare, but it can happen. And those more severe symptoms are usually delayed for 1 to 3 days. Fatalities are very rare, fortunately. Gastrointestinal symptoms usually subside within about 24 to 48 hours or so, but the neurologic and cardiovascular symptoms can persist for days or weeks, and in some cases even for months. And oddly enough, the neurologic symptoms can be worsened by stress, by drinking alcohol, or vigorous exercise. So if a patient does have ciguatera fish poisoning, they should be instructed to avoid all of those for several months afterwards. Treatment consists of supportive care. Activated charcoal can be beneficial in a case where the patient presents very early after the ingestion, but that really never happens. Most patients don't realize that they've eaten contaminated fish until many hours later when symptoms develop. The CDC and the FDA are very interested in gathering data on cases because they want to get a better picture of the incidence of the ciguatera fish poisoning. They feel that a lot of the cases are going unreported and that potentially the number of cases will increase as environmental factors change. So it's recommended that all cases or all possible cases be reported to your local poison center and then ultimately the FDA. The FDA will actually analyze the fish for the toxin at no cost. So just as a reminder, the local poison center can be reached by calling 1-800-222-1222. Now, there's another type of fish poisoning that's called scombroid or histamine fish poisoning, and that occurs when fish are eaten that haven't been properly refrigerated at any point in time between when they're caught and when they're prepared to be eaten. The fish spoil and bacteria on the spoiled fish produce histamine and other substances that aren't destroyed by cooking. Outbreaks in the United States have occurred after eating fish such as mahi-mahi, tuna, and bluefish, but there are other species that can be involved. Some people describe the spoiled fish as having a peppery taste, but not always. Symptoms usually begin within 5 minutes to 2 hours after eating the fish, and the symptoms include such things as flushing, itching, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and rarely bronchospasm. So they sound and look very much like an allergic reaction. Symptoms usually resolve on their own within 12 to 36 hours, but you can give antihistamines such as Benadryl or diphenhydramine, and they can ease the symptoms much more quickly. In rare cases of severe symptoms, steroids and epinephrine can be given. Now, it's important to remember also that since this is not a true allergic reaction to the fish itself, eating the same species that has been refrigerated properly in the future is safe in someone who's had a past reaction. So I just wanted to make your listeners aware of these fish poisonings because a lot of healthcare providers really aren't familiar with these, and we are seeing what we think is possibly an increase in the incidence of these poisonings.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I'll have to think about that the next time I order fish.
Right. Not all fish, but certain fish.
I know.
Unfortunately, it's difficult. You know, again, there's you can't look at the fish or taste it or there's no way of really knowing that fish has been contaminated. So it's a little scary in that respect, but it's not terribly common, but just something to think about.
Okay, Lisa. Well, thanks a lot. We'll look forward to hearing from you again next month.
Thanks, Jamie.
And you know what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center again for joining us and sharing her knowledge and expertise. And just remember that there are links to everything discussed in this and every other episode. You'll find that all over at nursingshow.com under the Nursing Podcast category. Check in over there. You'll find links to the news articles discussed here. You'll also find links to the Maryland Poison Center and other resources that you might find interesting regarding this particular topic. And again, Lisa's site is great. And you can also find over there links to sign up for her newsletter. And that's the Tox Tidbits email newsletter that you can get a lot of this information sent to you directly. It's a great way to stay up to date on poisonings and trends in toxicology. And you can find all of that over at mdpoison.com. Of course, nursingshow.com is your resource here. If you have any questions, any suggestions or comments about this or any other episode, please send them in. You can send them in here by email to comments@nursingshow.com, or you can leave a comment right there on the Nursing Show site at any of the articles. There's a link at the bottom for comments and responses. Go ahead and click on that link and you can share your thoughts with myself and the other readers and listeners here at the Nursing Show. That's it for me. I'm going to close out the show, as I always do, with some PodSafe music, some free available music for you that's made available for us here in the podcasting community. And I urge you to support these independent artists. Found a new one here for you this week, Michael Heaton, with a song. I guess it's one of his newer songs. It's called I Know What I Know. And you can find a link to his music in the show notes, as well as a link to head on over to iTunes. Check it out over there. And if you like what you hear, purchase it and let Michael know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. And I want to remind all of you to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Lost my